divided up the members of the board and were searching the databases, looking for anything that could point them to the one Stephen might have approached.
You?
He asked the others. From their terminals scattered down the long tables of the reading room, he heard mumbled,
No, nothing yet.
And more tapping.
I'm going to look up the dates from Stephen's notes, said Jean-Guy. Maybe there's something there.
What notes?
Alida Lenoir was sitting across from him and glanced at the piece of paper.
Agence France-Presse stories?
Beauvoir smiled. No. AFP are the initials of the dead man, Alexander Francis Plessner.
Are you sure?
Said the head archivist.
Pretty sure. But if you want to try Agence France-Presse, be my guest.
A few minutes later, Madame Lenoir sighed.
Nothing. I put the dates into the wire service site, and nothing unusual came up. A protest in Washington, European Union in turmoil, and the usual series of tragedies. Refugees fleeing brutal regimes and being turned back, a plane crash in the Urals, a bridge collapse in Spain, shootings in two American cities.
No mention of GHS? He asked.
Nothing.
No stories out of Patagonia or Luxembourg?
No.
Let me see that.
Madame de la Grangère had wandered over, and without waiting for him to give it to her, she snatched the scrap from his hand. Bet she could catch a fly with chopsticks, thought Jean-Guy. He got up and walked over to his mother-in-law.
Anything?
Not yet. No scandals to do with the board members, said Renmarie. No bankruptcies, no obvious need for money, no sudden big purchases. But I haven't finished yet. You?
But she already knew the answer.
Then a thought occurred to her. Are there any board members with the initials AFP? She asked, reaching for the report. They began putting the names into the searches. Sure enough, Annette Poppy, a former British Foreign Secretary, turned out to be Annette Forrester Poppy. Jean-Guy looked at his watch. It was 7:10.
I know this man,
came the voice of the chief librarian over Jean-Guy's shoulder. Madame de la Grangère was pointing to a member of the GHS engineering board.
He's the son of an old family friend. We were at the Sorbonne together.
She moved her finger so they could read his name. Alain Pinault. Alain Flaubert Pinault. They stared at the photo of the middle-aged man, thinning hair and fleshy face.
His father owned newspapers, said Madame de la Grangère. He asked if I'd tutor his son. As a favour, I agreed. What a waste of time.
Why do you say that? Asked Renmarie.
Because Alain Pinault was as dumb as they come, said the chief librarian. If stupid was sand, he'd be half the Sahara.
They looked at her.
Well, it's true. This guy's father knew I was into research. He hoped I could teach the kid how to track down information, prepare him for a job at the newspapers. But all he was interested in was partying. And yet,
they waited as Madame de la Grangère cast her mind back.
I quite liked him. He was a couple of years younger than me, spoiled, entitled, thick, but harmless. He had a poor brain, but a good heart.
She looked again at the photo.
Just before he flunked out of the Sorbonne, his father had him transferred to another university, and I lost track of him.
Where to? Asked Beauvoir.
I have no idea. Far away from the distractions of Paris is all I know.
Université de Montréal, said Renmarie, looking at Jean-Guy.
She entered Alain Flaubert Pinault's name into the archive database, and up came his biography.
Yes, says here he studied in Montreal, but not at UDM, McGill.
Renmarie and Jean-Guy stared at each other. An unruly young man sent far from home to study. It seemed more than likely his father would contact a friend in Montreal to watch over his idiot son. Was Stephen Horowitz that family friend? Was this the connection? They called up more information on this A.F. Pinault. Married with 3 children. Father died of cancer 15 years ago. Son took over the company and, against the wishes of his board, immediately expanded into cable, telecom, tech companies. He'd bought low after the tech bubble burst and turned hundreds of millions into billions.
Jesus, Maybe the guy's an idiot savant, said Madame de Lagrangier, though I saw no evidence of the savant part.
There, said Alida Lenoir, pointing to her screen. 6 years ago, Pinault's company bought a controlling interest in...
Agence France-Presse, said Renmarie, triumphant. That must be it.
Jean-Guy was shaking his head. We still don't have a connection between this guy and Stephen. We don't know whether AFP in his notes means Alain Pinault, or Agence France-Presse, or Plessner, or someone else.
Something's missing, said Madame de Lagrangier. Some link.
I'm going to write Mrs. McGillicuddy, said Renmarie, and find out if Stephen knew the Pinault family, and especially Alain Pinault. The four of them sat in individual pools of light, their fingers tap-tap-tapping on the keyboards, like the soft patter of feet sneaking up on a killer.
Daniel stared at the screen, jotted some notes. Then he looked up another file and made more notes. He'd been at it for almost an hour, exploring avenues and dead ends, eliminating possibilities, narrowing options. He'd started by trying to track down the numbered companies, with limited success. Then he went into the sell and buy orders, the ones stored for execution Monday morning. There were thousands, listed not by investor, but by investment. He needed to scroll through them all. His eyes were bloodshot, his concentration wavering. He stopped, went back. Something he'd passed needed another look. Daniel stared at the screen. A buy order had popped up, placed by Stephen Horowitz late Friday, to be executed first thing Monday morning.
Holy shit, he whispered.
He'd found out what Stephen was going to do with his billions, but it didn't tell him why. So absorbed was Daniel that he didn't hear the click of the door behind him. The rapid tapping of his fingers on the keyboard masked the soft approach of footsteps. He didn't hear the murmured voice advising the weekend supervisor to go back to his office and stay there. But he did feel the warm breath on his neck.
Neodymium is fairly common, Madame Arbour read off her phone. In China, less so elsewhere. The find in Patagonia would be significant.
Why? Asked Gamache, though he believed he knew the answer. Geopolitics. China was an authoritarian regime that could be as thin-skinned as it was brutal. Agreements were vulnerable to political machinations, regime change, subject to trade wars and tariffs, and a Western government that actually put human rights above profit.
The supply could not be guaranteed, said Madame Arbour, but a European company owning a rare earth mine in South America would be able to guarantee delivery.
You mentioned magnets. Is that neodymium's main use?
Yes.
Sounds harmless.
You're thinking of a normal magnet, but look at this.
She hit play, and Gamache watched as a piece of metal shot through a cantaloupe and slammed into a metal sheet.
Here's another one.
It showed a grown man, he looked like a weightlifter, trying to separate two steel rods stuck together.
Can you go back to the other video?
After re-watching it, he said,
A neodymium magnet did that?
Yes, and a small one.
Can it be used as a weapon?
It sure looked like that shard would pass through a human body.
It doesn't say. In an earlier search, I didn't find any reference to rare earth minerals as weapons. But they might have found a new use. Listen to this, Severine read. A neodymium magnet can lift 1,000 times its own weight.
But it also says here, Gamache was reading off her phone, that there's a problem with neodymium.
More like a caveat. When heated or frozen, it breaks down. And if under stress, it can shatter.
So it's unstable?
Not if it's used properly.
And what would those uses be? Asked Gamache.
She scrolled down.
Microphones, loudspeakers, computer hard drives, all the things we already know.
You mentioned cutting-edge telecommunications earlier. That's exactly the sort of investment Stephen would notice.
Gamache leaned back in the comfortable chair, staring at the small screen. It didn't make sense. Nothing they'd discovered was, as far as he could tell, unethical, never mind illegal. So why the secrecy? What were they hiding? From what they could tell, GHS was mining the rare earth element, then shipping the raw ore to refineries. And then? He took off his glasses and narrowed his eyes. Can you go back to that second video? She did, and this time played it all the way through. The strong man finally managed to separate the bars after a struggle that clearly left him embarrassed. The nickels, Gamache said.
Pardon?
Asked Madame Arbour. His irises were moving, as though he was watching a film no one else could see. Then he looked at his watch. 8:10, almost time to make his way to Place de la Concorde and his meeting with Claude Dussault. He had one stop to make first. But what to do with Séverine Arbour? Take her with him, or leave her here in the Lutetia? If she came with him, and she turned out to be a spy planted in their midst, he'd be putting them all at risk. But if she wasn't a spy, and he left her in the bar, something awful might happen to her. There was, Chief Inspector Gamache knew as he stood up, no decision to be made. Come with me, please. More than one set of eyes watched them leave Bar Josephine. Chapter 35.
Nothing, said Reine-Marie, staring at the screen as though accusing it of willfully withholding information.
While waiting for Mrs. McGillicuddy's reply about Stephen and Pino, she'd gone back over Agence France-Presse stories on the dates Stephen had jotted down. She was getting frustrated. This was, after all, her forte, tracking down information, finding things hidden in full view but overlooked. She was, she knew, overlooking something. It was the reflection in the screen she was annoyed at, not the screen itself. Then she had an idea.
Suppose the dates are when the thing actually happened?
Yes, said Jean-Guy. Isn't that what we're looking up?
No, we're looking up the dates the Agence France-Presse stories ran.
Wouldn't they be the same thing?
Not necessarily, said Reine-Marie. Sometimes it takes a while for an event to be discovered or to be reported on, especially an event in an isolated region like, say, Patagonia. We need to check stories on either side of the dates.
A few minutes later, she called Jean-Guy over to her terminal.
Look at this. An Agence France-Presse reporter disappeared in Patagonia 4 years ago. It happened on the first date Stephen's written down, but the story didn't run until 3 days later. That's why we didn't find it the first time.
Overhearing this, Judith and Elida went to look.
Annick Guardiola, 24, stringer for AFP, Judith read. Disappeared in the mountains of Patagonia while on a hiking trip.
Alone? Asked Jean-Guy.
Apparently.
Who hikes in those mountains alone? Did they find her? He asked.
Just a moment, said Reine-Marie, as she put the young woman's name in the search engine. Agence France-Presse sent representatives to the area, she said, leaning into her screen and reading, and pressured the local government.
The police, the carabineros, didn't seem to take it seriously, said Alida.
Her body was eventually found in a gorge, said Judith from her terminal behind them, where she'd also brought up the story. If you go a week later, you'll find the report. The police ruled her death an accident, said that she'd fallen, but AFP wasn't satisfied. Their head of news says neither her phone nor her computer were found. But then...
There was a pause as Judith scrolled.
It goes quiet. The story dies.
They looked at each other.
Dies? The cops and the paper just dropped it? Said Alida. Does that make sense?
No, said Jean-Guy, staring at the screen. Someone was bought off.
You think she was murdered?
Reine-Marie asked. I think she found out something someone really wanted to hide, he said, his fingers hitting the keys, chasing information. But what? More tapping. Tapping. Tap.
Got it, said Judith.
The chief librarian had let the others follow the Guardiola lead while she took a different tack. It had struck them as strange that the dates were all in chronological order, except the final entry. The last thing he'd written was, in fact, the earliest date. They'd thought perhaps he'd transposed numbers, but now it seemed not. It was the last thing he'd discovered, but the first thing that had happened.
A month before Annick Guardiola disappeared, she wrote a story about the derailment of several train cars in Colombia, said Judith, as the others crowded around. It was a minor story, so it wasn't picked up by Agence France-Presse until a week later and sent out as a brief.
Colombia? Not Patagonia? Asked Renmarie.
No. See here. Colombia.
Was anyone killed? Asked Alida.
No, said Judith, scanning. No one died. It was a freight train.
Carrying ore from the neodymium mine? Asked Jean-Guy.
No. Grain. So why was Annick Guardiola interested? Asked Judith.
Why was Stephen? Asked Renmarie.
Jean-Guy picked up his phone. It was time to call Armand.
Oui?
Patron, we've found something. Jean-Guy did not identify himself. While he suspected this precaution was meaningless, it made him feel slightly better about breaking their silence.
Gamache and Madame Arbour were in a taxi moving across Paris. The light turned red, and in the pause he watched patrons in a brasserie spilling out onto the sidewalk, drinking and eating, carefree. Though he knew very few people were ever really carefree. But there were moments of bliss. He thought of his last moment of bliss, walking along after dinner Friday night, before... Like all those locked in a nightmare, he wished he could wind back the clock, set down the cracked cup. Then the light changed, and the taxi moved on through the night, as he listened to Jean-Guy. It looks like Stephen did mean Agence France-Presse when he wrote AFP. He told Gamache about the derailment in Colombia, the disappearance of the reporter who'd written the story, and that her body was eventually found in a gorge in Patagonia.
Near the mine?
We're trying to find out. The local police dismissed it as a hiking accident.
She was alone?
It seems so. AFP sent people to investigate. They discovered that neither her phone nor her laptop were found on her, or in her hotel room.
She was murdered.
Looks like it. Though the local authorities never agreed and didn't investigate, and eventually the story died.
Really?
The local cops must have been paid off.
She was onto something, said Gamache. But what?
Might be the derailment, or might not.
Have you figured out the other dates?
We're working on it. Jean-Guy paused, wondering if he should say more. Knowing their phones were probably being monitored, but it also felt like they'd passed the point of no return.
Do you know an Alain Pinault? The media fellow? Yes.
He's on the GHS engineering board. I saw him just now at the Lutetia.
Why?
His company owns Agence France-Presse. There was a pause as Gamache absorbed that news and considered what it could mean.
But do you know him personally? Jean-Guy asked.
No. Should I? Jean-Guy told him about McGill and the possible connection to Stephen. Renmarie's written to Mrs. McGillicuddy to see if Stephen did know him. This would have been 30 years ago or more. Stephen never mentioned him?
Not that I remember. If he was looking out for Monsieur Pinault back then, I'd have thought he'd introduce us. We'd be about the same age, no?
He's a couple of years younger, but yes, that's what I thought too. Jean-Guy was obviously a little disappointed. There might not be a connection between Alain Pinault and Stephen Horowitz after all. If there was, Stephen would almost certainly have introduced the wild young man to his more stable godson.
I might have been away at university, said Armand. Let me know what you find.
Any news your end?
Seems neodymium, while a rare earth element, isn't exactly rare. It's a powerful magnet, but that's about it. We're looking into the telecommunications connection. Still, it's puzzling why GHS kept the finder's secret.
Maybe that's just the culture, said Jean-Guy. They don't exactly like broadcasting their business.
That's probably it. Both men knew Jean-Guy's statement was for the benefit of whoever might be listening. The truth was, this wasn't extreme secrecy. It was a cover-up.
Is Reine-Marie there? Can I have a word?
Armand?
He heard her say.
Jean-Guy told you what we found?
Yes, much more than we've found. Have you heard from Daniel?
Not yet. Do you want me to call him?
No, I'll do that. Let me know what Mrs. McGillicuddy says about Stephen and Monsieur Pino.
Absolutely. Armand?
Oui?
Everything all right?
Yes, we're moving forward, getting closer and closer. He chose not to tell her where they were getting closer to. If GHS was good at keeping secrets, they were amateurs compared to the head of homicide. Though the key was knowing what information to let slip and what to hold on to. He called Daniel, heard it ring and ring. And then Daniel's recorded voice, deep, cheerful, warm, inviting him to leave a message.
Daniel, it's Dad. Call me when you can.
Up ahead, he could see their apartment, and in it, what he'd dashed across Paris to find. Since silence was already broken, Jean-Guy decided to make one more call. As soon as he heard Annie's voice, he relaxed. Until that moment, he had no idea how tense he'd become.
Everything all right? He asked.
Just fine. Honoré and the girls have had their dinner and baths, and we're just tucking them in. Did you know Great Aunt Ruth has taught him a song?
Oh, God, what now?
Their son's very first word hadn't been mama or papa or milk or please. Thanks to Great Aunt Ruth and her duck Rosa, Honoré's first word had been fuck, which he'd screamed loud and clear in the middle of a party, repeatedly. Annie and Jean-Guy had tried to explain that he was actually saying duck, but his enunciation was so perfect, no one believed that. Honoré adored Great-Aunt Ruth and her duck Rosa, and absorbed anything they chose to imprint.
Here, listen, said Annie, and held the phone out.
In a clear, high voice, their son was singing, What Do You Do With a Drunken Sailor? A sea shanty, Jesus, sighed Jean-Guy. Still, he can hold a tune.
Yes, that's the thing to focus on.
You're all right, he repeated.
Yes.
A few minutes earlier, she'd felt a twinge. It was, she told herself, indigestion, though in her heart, and slightly further down, she knew it wasn't that. She could feel panic rising, but she wouldn't say anything to him. Not yet. Not until she was sure.
I'll tell you more when I see you, Jean-Guy was saying.
Come home when you can, she said.
Soon, soon. As he said goodbye, he heard in the background, Way, hey, and up she rises.
No need to take off your coat, said Armand as they entered the apartment. We aren't staying long.
Long enough for me to use the facilities?
Madame Arbour asked, her voice brusque. Clearly not used to being lugged all over the city like a sack of occasionally intelligent potatoes.
Oui, c'est Armand, he said. It's just off the bedroom.
When she left, he went over to the box from the hospital. It was still where they'd left it the night before, sitting beside the armchair in the living room. Taking the top off, he looked in, and jerked back in surprise. Something had been added. Even covered in a cloth, he knew what it was. He unwrapped the gun, careful not to get his prints on it. Was this the weapon that had killed Alexander Plessner? Was he being set up now? He smelled the muzzle. It had not been fired recently, but that meant nothing. Using a handkerchief, he released the magazine. It was fully loaded, but he ejected one of the bullets. It was not standard issue. Hollow point, illegal, brutal. Effective if the effect you wanted was to blow a hole clean through another human being. No. This was something else entirely. He stared at the bullet for a moment, his mind whirring. Replacing it, he looked around.
someone had broken into their apartment between the time he and Reine-Marie had stopped there that afternoon on their way to the Louvre, and now. Was anything else changed, added, taken? Without a thorough search, he couldn't tell, and he didn't have time for that. Who'd done this? Claude Dussault? Irena Fontaine? Thierry Gérard? Xavier Loisel? And why? He looked at the firearm in his hand. What was the purpose? The water stopped running, and he knew he had moments to decide what to do. He slipped the gun into his coat pocket and bent over the box once again. Then he hesitated and changed his mind. Walking quickly over to the bookcase, he pulled a few books out of a high shelf and hid the gun there. When Séverine Abour reappeared, she found Gamache going through the box. "What's that?" she asked, joining him. "These are the things Stephen had on his desk, and what the hospital gave us after he was hit by the truck. The investigators have kept his laptop and phone, but everything else is here."
"What are you looking for?"
She'd been a bit surprised by the apartment. It was smaller than she'd expected. Most powerful people, men in particular, liked homes that reflected what they saw as their place on the ladder, which was, in reality, a few rungs lower than their egos believed. This place was petite, beamed, with bookcases and a fireplace. The floors were parquet, in the classic herringbone pattern. An old oak dining table shared space with a comfortable sofa and armchairs. The kitchen, through an archway, was compact and dated. But it was calm, peaceful even. It smelled of coffee and wood, and felt like home.
"Neodymium," he said.
As she watched, he dug into his pocket and dropped a handful of coins into the box. It was such a bizarre thing to do. For a moment she wondered about his sanity. But he looked completely, intensely sane. Stirring the contents with his hand, he picked up the coins, along with some screws and the Allen wrench.
Nothing.
And she understood. If something in there was made of neodymium, it would pull metal to it and magnetize what it touched. He sat back in the chair and stared at her. "So what magnetized the nickels?"
"Nickels?"
"Stephen had two Canadian nickels that were stuck together. We thought they were glued. The seal was that strong. But when I saw that video about neodymium, I realized they might have been magnetized."
"Which would mean your friend had a sample of the neodymium," she said. "That's what had magnetized the coins. Is that what you thought was in the box? The neodymium itself?"
"I'd hoped." It was now clear that his godfather had had suspicions for years, had spent the last precious years of his life and any amount of his fortune to piece together the evidence, had brought the engineer and his trusted friend Alexander Plessner in to help. He'd sold everything he owned, mortgaged his home, gone all in. But what had he found out? Was it corporate espionage? Was it something to do with neodymium? They knew, he realized, almost nothing. He checked his watch. 8:45, time he left for the rendezvous. But he wasn't armed with information or anything else. He glanced at the bookcase. Had he just made a fatal error? But it was done now. He called Daniel at the bank again, and again, no answer.
"Something wrong?"
Séverine Abour asked.
"No."
He stared at his phone, then hit the app. Within seconds it showed Daniel's location. Armand exhaled. He was at the bank, probably with his phone on silent.
"I'm going to meet Commissioner Dussault," he said.
"Can I go home now?" she asked.
"I'm afraid not."
"You still don't trust me. What do I have to do?"
"It's not that," he said, though of course it was. "It won't be safe for you at home. The only safety is in numbers. You need to join the others at the archives. You'll be fine there."
"Fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and egotistical?"
When he looked surprised, she explained,
"Beauvoir told me about your Quebec village. He talks about it a lot. Apparently it's filled with fine people."
They'd left the apartment and were walking quickly through the dark streets of the Marais, trying without success to avoid puddles on their way to the archives. Armand laughed.
They're certainly fine. And so am I.
He called Reine-Marie, and when they approached the massive gates, he saw her and Jean-Guy waiting for them on the other side. He was surprised by the wave of emotion that washed over him, and by the gulf that existed between them, the immeasurable distance between in there and out here.
Let me come with you, said Jean-Guy. Claude wants to speak to me alone.
I can still be there, watch from a distance.
And do what? Asked Armand.
Without being more explicit, they both knew if it came to that, Armand would be dead before he hit the ground, and there'd be nothing Jean-Guy could do except get himself killed.
Stay here, said Armand. I'll be in touch as soon as I can.
As he left them for his rendezvous, he felt very alone.
Chapter 36.
Magnificent, isn't it? Said Claude Dussault as he took his place beside Gamache. Almost mesmerizing.
The two men stared at the Fontaine de Mer on the Place de la Concorde. It was lit up in the dark, so that what spouted from the leaping dolphins looked more like quicksilver than water.
It is, agreed Armand.
He hadn't paused to admire the fountain in years, always passing right by on his way from the Champs-Élysées to the Tuileries Garden. But now he stared, and noticed that the centre of the huge fountain was supported by mythical figures representing the oceans, each sitting in the bow of a ship. The symbol of Paris, the storm-tossed vessel threatened but never foundering.
When I was growing up, said Dussault, no one threw coins in fountains to make wishes. Seems incredible anyone thinks that works.
The next thing Gamache heard was a plop.
Then again, said Dussault, who was watching his coin sink to the bottom, it probably couldn't hurt. You might want to make a wish, too.
What do you want, Claude?
Far from being put off by the abrupt question, Commissioner Dussault nodded, appreciating that there was no longer a need for pretense.
I thought it was time we talked. Alone.
Are we alone? Asked Gamache.
What do you think?
Dussault looked this way, then that, then began strolling around the fountain.
I think it's time for the truth, said Gamache, falling in beside him. You're involved in this, aren't you?
They were walking slowly, heads tilted toward each other, a moment of quiet companionship between two old friends. That would be the perception. The reality was, as it so often is, far different.
Perhaps, said Dussault.
Gamache was struggling to remain civil when standing so close to a man who'd all but admitted his role in the attempt on Stephen's life, in the cold-blooded murder of Alexander Plessner, an elderly, unarmed man. Around them, floodlights lit up the magnificent monuments. Vehicles passed by. Distinctive French sirens sounded in the distance. Visitors took selfies in front of the statues. Armand heard snippets of conversations and bursts of laughter. But mostly he absorbed the words and subtle movements of the man beside him. The prefect stopped in front of the Luxor obelisk. Etched into the base of the great column were what many mistook for ancient hieroglyphics, but which were actually diagrams describing the engineering involved in bringing the 3,000-year-old monument from Egypt to Paris, then erecting it on this site.
Amazing what engineers can do, said Dussault. Where would we be without them? They're the real magicians.
What do you want?
Did you know this was where much of the terror took place?
Dussault looked at his companion. But of course you do. You're a student of history.
You know that Madame la Guillotine stood right on this spot. Louis XVI, Marie Antoinette, so many others lost their lives right here.
He looked at the people laughing and taking selfies.
Do you think they know? Do you think they care?
Dussault turned to face him.
You're a smart man, but like them, I don't think you have any idea what you're close to.
Oh, I have some idea. He stared at Dussault with undisguised disgust. I saw the security video. You tried to have it erased, but they missed some. You were in the Georges V Friday afternoon with Thierry Gérard. You met with Eugénie Roquebrune. You're running Secure Fort, with Girard once again your second in command. You ordered the killing of Stephen and Monsieur Plessner. You're the one who's behind all this.
Dussault nodded, resigned.
I'm sorry you found that video. Sloppy.
He tilted his head back, staring at the gold pyramid at the very top of the obelisk.
Did you know the top of the obelisk was stolen in Luxor in the 6th century BC? What's up there now is fairly recent. People mistake it for original, but...
Why are we here?
I don't know why you came. Seems an awful risk. It's true I took that meeting, but it's a huge leap of logic to go from my having tea with friends to being guilty of murder, don't you think? Don't overreach, Armand. That's when you fall.
Are you denying it?
I'm saying you don't know everything. Far from it. I tried to warn you once, and you didn't listen. Alexander Plessner is dead, and Stephen Horowitz is dying.
Dussault waited, but Armand didn't argue.
What you're doing will only make things worse.
You forgot Annick Guardiola.
You know about her?
Yes, so did Stephen.
That's too bad.
Claude Dussault lowered his voice.
You and Reine-Marie need to get your family and leave. Get on a plane and go back to Montreal. For God's sake, I'm begging you.
You know I won't do that, so stop wasting time.
You're a fool. The only consolation is that it's probably too late anyway. For you. For your son.
Armand froze. Daniel?
Dussault turned and began walking toward the Seine. But Armand reached out, grabbed his arm and swung him around.
What have you done? He demanded. Where is he?
He's safe.
Dussault held his eyes.
But you know what they can do, and will do. What you don't know is what they've already done. Those three, Plessner, Horowitz, the journalist, they're not even the tip of the iceberg. You have no idea how powerful these people are. And now, thanks to your godfather, how desperate.
Are you threatening to hurt Daniel?
When Dussault didn't answer or blink, Armand lowered his voice.
If you touch my son, I'll bring holy hell down on you.
Too late, said Dussault. It's already here. The funny thing about hell is that we assume it's obvious. Fire, brimstone, we'll be plunged into it by some horrific event in our lives. But the truth is, hell can be as subtle as heaven.
He looked around.
Sometimes we don't recognize we've wandered into hell until it's too late.
Where's Daniel?
Dussault focused on the man in front of him.
Know this, Armand. I tried to help. If something happens to Daniel or any member of your family, it won't be on me. It'll be your fault.
Where's Daniel?
You bumbled in, you and your little group, like some amateur theatre troupe putting on a show.
Dussault shook his head.
You think you're so clever, going to the top of the Eiffel Tower, going to the basement and whispering about Patagonia. You thought you were moving forward, but that's an illusion. You don't even see the truck hurtling toward you. It's 2 feet away, and you can't stop it. You and your family are nothing more than bugs on a windshield to these people.
Gamache grabbed Claude Dussault, lifting him almost off the ground, bringing the shorter man to eye level, within millimeters of his face.
Where's my son?
Put me down.
Dussault's voice was strangled by his coat.
Oh, it ends now.
Gamache's grip tightened. Then, against every instinct he possessed, his clenched and cramped fingers released the coat.
Dussault had all but admitted there were snipers aimed at him. If he went down, all was lost. If Daniel was to have a chance, if any of them were, he had to think clearly, act rationally. Gamache took several deep breaths and brought the thudding in his chest under control.
You asked for this meeting before you took Daniel. You want something.
Dussault raised his brows. Gamache had recovered his senses far faster than he'd expected.
There is one possible way out of this.
Gamache recognized what had just happened. It was a common technique. Scare, threaten, raise the pressure and the stakes until the person was out of their mind with terror. Then offer them a way out. Even as he recognized it, he also recognized that it worked. He was terrified and he was desperate. And he was listening.
How?
There's something they want. Something your godfather has.
What Thierry Girard was looking for in Stephen's apartment. Something to do with the neodymium mine.
Dussault pressed his lips together. Armand could see that Dussault hadn't expected him to know so much. This was not working out as Dussault had planned. But neither was it going as Armand had hoped. Both had delivered punches, and now both were reeling. But Armand knew he was by far the more bruised. Dussault had Daniel, and therefore Dussault had him. But Claude had said there was a chance.
You want me to find whatever evidence Stephen's hidden. That's why you've taken Daniel, to make sure I do it.
Added incentive, yes. It needs to be found before tomorrow morning's board meeting.
And if I do?
I think I can convince them to release your son and let you all leave Paris.
Armand stared at his feet. Then, looking up, he gave a small nod, as though he believed him.
I'll need to see Daniel.
Dussault brought out his iPhone.
No, I mean in person. There must be,
the familiar phrase Armand had used so often in hostage negotiations, now stuck in his throat, so that for a moment he tasted vomit.
Proof of life.
Dussault considered the man in front of him.
Follow me.
He turned and walked briskly away from the ghosts of the Place de la Concorde. They walked for 10 minutes, in silence, Armand Gamache following Dussault along Boulevard Saint-Germain, past the young lovers and elderly men and women arm in arm. Though one elderly woman caught his eye and smiled reassuringly, as though she knew that all would be well. Daniel's father clung to the look in those clear and kindly eyes long after she was gone. He knew it was an illusion, a delusion, but it comforted him as he walked through the darkness. When they turned down Boulevard Raspail, Armand knew where they were going, where Daniel had been taken. It was both cruel and kind. Armand was both sickened and relieved. They were holding Daniel in Stephen's apartment, a place Daniel had visited many times, where his son had happy memories and where he might be less afraid. But it was one more violation for Armand, his own safe place defiled beyond redemption. When they arrived, Madame Faubourg came out to greet them.
It's wonderful to see Daniel. I hope you don't mind my letting him and his friends into Monsieur Horowitz's apartment. He did have the GSPS card.
She leaned closer to Armand.
Not that he needed it. I'd have let him in anyway.
Light spilled from the open door to her apartment, and with it the scent of ginger and molasses.
Any more news about Monsieur Horowitz?
I'm afraid not.
I won't be staying long, but I think Daniel and his friends might stay the night. Sort through things. Best not to disturb them.
Of course.
She nodded to Dussault and wiped her hands on her apron as she watched them walk through the courtyard. In the elevator, Gamache turned to Dussault.
How can you be part of this? What happened?
Don't be so fucking sanctimonious, Armand. Have you looked around? What's the difference between this and the tobacco companies? The pharmaceuticals that continue to sell drugs they know are killing people. Airlines that fly planes they know are dangerous.
elevators that plunge to the ground? How about nuclear power stations coming online? Engineers who continue to use faulty and inferior materials? The governments that drop regulations in favor of profit? They're killing thousands, hundreds of thousands. Don't look at me like that. Don't tell me you haven't knowingly endangered innocent lives, justifying it as for the greater good. Where's the line?
That's your justification. I'll tell you where the line is. It's buried under that pile of corpses you helped make.
The elevator jerked to a stop, and Dussault yanked the metal accordion door open.
You can't win. Since you refuse to leave, what you're fighting for now is how badly you're going to lose. How much you're going to lose. If they think you know what Horowitz has and aren't telling them, they'll kill Daniel now, in front of you. And then they'll go to the archives, hunt down everyone there, and kill them. And then they'll go to the Georges V.
Enough.
And they'll kill everyone there, one by one, until you hand it over.
You do that? Demanded Armand, horrified. You'd let them do that?
I can't stop it, even if I wanted to. Fuck, Armand, they're the truck, and you're the bug. You and your family are about a millimeter away from that windshield now.
But I don't know what Stephen found. Maybe nothing.
Armand felt himself sliding into panic.
Maybe he just had suspicions and no hard evidence. He might have hoped it would be enough to frighten the board. He might have thought, coming from him, that would be enough.
He stared at Claude Dussault, desperate now.
Maybe there's nothing to find.
You'd better pray there is, and that you find it.
Dussault knocked, then opened the door to Stephen's apartment. Four men stood up and turned to them. One of them, Gamache saw with near despair, was Xavier Loisel. He was holding an assault rifle. On Daniel.
Chapter 37. Armand pushed past Dussault. Xavier Loisel swung his weapon toward him, but Dussault simply gestured, and Loisel stepped back. Armand grabbed Daniel and held him close, whispering,
"I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
He could feel Daniel trembling as he clutched his father. Then Armand pulled away, and, holding Daniel at arm's length, he examined the bruise and blood on his son's face. Then he turned to the three large men.
"Who did this?"
"I did,"
came a voice from the dining room.
And Thierry Gérard appeared.
"He wouldn't tell us what he found at the bank. But then," Gérard smiled, "he did."
"Dad, I'm sorry."
"They already knew,"
said Armand, his voice a snarl. He faced Gérard.
"You already knew what he found, didn't you? But you beat him anyway, you sadistic shit."
Gamache took a step toward him, then stopped, frozen in place by a familiar sound, the soft metallic click of a safety coming off. He turned to his son. Daniel's eyes were wide with terror as the gun pressed against his temple.
"You're right," said Gérard, his voice conversational, almost chatty. "We did know. But you, better than most, know the advantage of having a cooperative witness. Sometimes people just have to see the full advantage of being helpful, and the disadvantage of not."
Gamache glared at him.
"I'll kill you."
"Ah, you just slipped from your favorite spot on the higher ground, Chief Inspector," said Gérard. "What does it feel like to be in the dung with the rest of us?"
"You'd better frisk him," said Dussault. "Make sure he's unarmed."
Gamache glared at Loisel as he frisked him. "Nothing." Then he gave Gamache a quick jab in the solar plexus with the butt of his machine gun, dropping him to his knees.
"Dad?"
Armand raised a hand to indicate he was all right, then struggled to his feet. As he did, he looked at Claude Dussault. The prefect's brows had risen very slightly, in surprise, in annoyance. At Loisel's blow? No. Claude Dussault had expected Loisel to find a gun
Armand knew then that Dussault had planted the weapon in his apartment, in the box of Stephen's things, where he was bound to find it. And do what? Use it? Or try to? But if so, why insist he be frisked? Why give it to him, only to have it taken away? Had Dussault expected Armand to pull it on him in the Place de la Concorde, in a rage when told about Daniel? If he had, he'd have been immediately gunned down by the heavily armed police who patrolled the place. Another execution. Was that what Dussault wanted? But no, that didn't make complete sense. They didn't want him dead. They needed him alive to find Stephen's evidence. So why had Claude Dussault left a gun in his apartment? And did he really expect that the head of homicide for the Sûreté du Québec wouldn't notice what it was loaded with?
Dad, Stephen,
Daniel began, and once again Loisel raised his rifle and Daniel cringed.
Let him tell his father what he found at the bank, said Dussault. Monsieur Gamache here needs to know if he's going to help us.
Armand's eyes held Daniel's, and he said softly, gently, tell me. It was the same voice he'd used tucking Daniel into bed.
Tell me about your day.
And the little boy would. It would all come spilling out from a child who found wonder everywhere. He'd hear about the odd-shaped clouds, the piles of autumn leaves, the snow forts Daniel and his friends had built and defended, the carefree battles waged and won, the first daffodils in the park, and the splashing in the fountain on a sizzling summer's day.
Tell me, Armand said now.
And Daniel did.
Stephen put in a buy order late Friday, just as the New York market closed. He was going all in on two of GHS's holdings.
The numbered companies?
Oui.
What do the companies do?
One's a tool and die company, but his main target is a smelter.
Armand's mind raced. A smelter meant ore. Ore came from mines, which led to GHS, which led to Patagonia, which led to the rare earth elements, which led to neodymium. Armand's eyes flickered to Daniel's pocket.
Oh God, he thought, that's where they are.
The nickels, the ones he'd been looking for earlier in the box, magnetized, not glued, together. Armand saw again Honoré in the garden and the mighty toss. Saw Jean-Guy's panic, thinking his son had them in his mouth. And he saw Daniel, in the background, stoop and pick up the nickels, putting them in his jacket pocket for safekeeping, away from the hands and mouths of other children. And that's where they still were, in the same jacket Daniel was now wearing. If Dussault put it together and realized what they were, if they found them on Daniel and thought he was deliberately hiding them, Armand quickly considered his options. Bringing out a handkerchief, he looked at Daniel, then over to Dussault.
Is it all right if I...
Dussault nodded. He approached Daniel, and as he wiped the blood from his son's face, Daniel grabbed his arms and whispered, whimpered, his voice high and strained.
I'm not brave, Dad. I'm so afraid.
Armand pulled him close and held him tight.
I'm here. It's all right. I've got you.
He stepped back and looked his son in the eye.
And you are brave. You're still standing. Most would be curled on the floor by now. Remember Superman.
Daniel gave one gruff, unexpected laugh. It was something he'd explained to his father at great length when he was six, that at first Superman was completely invincible. But then his creators, one was Canadian, Daniel had excitedly said. Realized that was a mistake.
They had to have something that could hurt him,
the earnest little boy had explained.
And do you know why that is?
His father had asked. Daniel had taken his time to think about it. 2 days later, he'd slipped his hand into his dad's as they walked through the park to the playground and said,
Because you can't be brave if you're not afraid.
Oui,
his father agreed. And watched Daniel run off to play with the other kids.
Please, Dad,
Daniel now said.
Tell me you were a commando.
Better,
his father leaned closer and dropped his voice further.
I taught commandos.
Stepping back, he looked at the handkerchief. Renmarie had given it to him as a stocking stuffer at Christmas. It was now stained with their son's blood. Just as he went to put it back in his pocket, Girard reached out and bent Gamache's hand back, almost breaking his fingers. Gamache winced and twisted, opening his hand and dropping the handkerchief. Girard examined it, nothing hidden in the folds. Then he tossed it back at Gamache. He could have just asked to see it, Gamache knew, as he flexed his hand and replaced the handkerchief in his pocket, or even snatched it away from him. But instead, Thierry Girard had chosen to hurt. Not much, but even a little seemed to give Girard pleasure. Here was a sadist with a gun, and Armand Gamache wondered just how much control Claude Dussault really did have over his second-in-command. "You have until tomorrow morning at 7:30 to find whatever it is Stephen Horowitz has hidden," said Dussault. "The GHS board meeting is at 8. We need it before then."
"You've looked for it for weeks and haven't found anything," Gamache said. "But you want me to find it in hours?"
"I think you can do it," said Dussault, "given the motivation."
Gamache looked at him with loathing.
"If you really want me to succeed, I need more information. What's GHS up to? I have to know what I'm looking for."
"You're smart," said Dussault. "I think you'll know it when you see it."
He looked at his watch.
"It's now 10:53. You have almost 9 hours.
"I'll need help. Someone needs to come with me."
"Did you have someone in mind?" asked Dussault.
"Daniel."
Dussault smiled.
"Saw that coming. And no, he stays safe with us."
"Then Beauvoir. Let me bring Beauvoir in. Together we have a chance."
Dussault made a subtle gesture toward Girard, and the two men stepped away to consult in a corner. Watching them, Gamache could see that Dussault was definitely in charge and had complete control over the brute Girard. What should have been a relief was actually even more alarming.
"You have your Beauvoir," said Dussault, returning to them.
Gamache put out his hand for his phone, and as Girard gave it to him, he said,
"Put it on speaker."
Armand noticed that several calls and texts had come in from Renmarie. He was sorely tempted to read them, but knew he had to place the call first. It rang only once before he heard Jean-Guy's excited voice.
"Annie's gone into labour. We're heading to the hospital."
The emotions were so strong, so conflicting, that for a moment Armand felt light-headed, as though he'd been spun in a centrifuge.
"Allô?" said Jean-Guy. "You still there?"
"Oui. Is Annie all right?"
"Hi, Dad," came her voice. "I'm here in the car with Jean-Guy and Maman. You coming?"
"As soon as I can. I'm with Daniel,
and we're just discussing our next step.
Renmarie?" "I'm here," came her voice. "Everything okay with you? Daniel's with you?"
Daniel called out,
"Salut, Mama. Everything's fine."
Armand heard the cheerful tone coming from his bloodstained son. How could he possibly think he wasn't brave?
"Alida and Judith are still there, along with Severine," said Renmarie. "We haven't been able to make any connection between the dates in Stephen's notes and GHS. It's frustrating."
"Not to worry. We'll figure it out.
And there are more important things right now. Annie?"
"Yes, Dad."
"We'll be there as soon as we can. I love you."
"I love you too, Papa," she said,
though he could hear her disappointment and slight confusion that her father wasn't also rushing to the hospital to be there with her.
"Wait a minute," said Jean-Guy. "You called me. Did you want something?"
"Just a check-in. Please, please let me know about the baby and Annie."
"You'll be here long before anything happens."
There was a pause.
"Are you all right? What did you so want?"
"It was a fishing expedition, trying to figure out what we know."
"So he is involved in all this?"
"I'm not so sure. Look, this will wait. You have far more important things happening. If we're not there before she arrives, tell your daughter that her uncle and grandfather love her."
"You'll tell her yourselves.
Armand. But Gamache had hung up before Jean-Guy could say more.
Congratulations, said Girard as he took the phone back. Happy day.
He read the emails and texts, then handed the phone to Dussault, who also read them. Reine-Marie had been trying to reach Armand to tell him about Annie.
Shame Beauvoir can't join you. I suspect your chances of success, never great, have just collapsed.
Dussault handed the phone back to Gamache.
I'll need the JSPS card. Armand walked over to Daniel. I gave mine to him.
Sliding his hand into Daniel's pocket, he found the card and felt for the coins.
Let me see, said Girard, when Armand withdrew his hand.
It held only the card.
Should we send one of them with him? Asked Girard, indicating the guards.
No, no need. What's he going to do? Run away? Go to the police?
Dussault smiled.
All we need are the documents. I don't care how he does it, but he'll be faster, more efficient without one of them tagging along.
Armand turned to Daniel.
I have to leave, but I'll be back in time, I promise.
He pulled Daniel to him in a bear hug and whispered,
I'm so proud of you. I love you.
Daniel nodded.
Chapter 38. Armand unlocked the door to their apartment in the Marais and quickly went over to the bookcase. The gun was still there. Slipping it into his coat pocket, he locked up and left. But where to? He had no idea where Stephen and Plessner had hidden the evidence, if there even was any. Had Stephen and Plessner uncovered a scam, claiming to use neodymium in next-generation telecommunications, where actually it didn't work, taking investors' money on false pretenses? Or maybe it was real, and GHS needed to protect a breakthrough that would net them billions? Was it corporate espionage? Fraud? Money laundering? What had that young journalist found in the mountains of Patagonia? And how could the derailment of a train in Colombia 4 years ago have anything to do with it? There was something, something terrible enough to murder, and now he had just hours to find it. Armand stood on the sidewalk outside their door and looked this way, then that. He honestly had no idea where to go next. He turned toward the Seine and started walking, his mind racing. Though he tried to slow it down, to marshal his thoughts. What did they know? For one thing, Claude Dussault had let slip that he knew that they'd talked about Patagonia in the sub-basement of the Georges V, which meant he knew everything they'd discussed, which meant there was an informant in their midst. And that could be only one person, Severine Arbour. What had Dussault said? That the deaths Gamache knew about weren't even the tip of the iceberg. GHS was responsible for many, many more, on a scale almost unimaginable. Gamache stopped, realizing he was standing across from the Hôpital Hôtel Dieu, where Annie was busy giving birth and Stephen was busy dying. He took a step off the curb toward the entrance. Then he stepped back. No, he couldn't give in to the nearly overwhelming temptation to go in. In an act so painful he was trembling, Armand Gamache turned his back on them and walked on, sparing a glance at Notre Dame. Then he turned his back on that too, though he allowed his thoughts to linger on the heroics of the men and women who'd run in to save the artifacts, who'd fought the fire at risk to themselves. Hell might be empty, but there was evidence of the divine in their midst too. The trick, as Stephen had taught him in the garden of the Musée Rodin so many years ago, was to see both. Dreadful deeds were obvious, the divine was often harder to see. And which, he heard Stephen's voice and still felt the tap on his chest, would have more weight with you, garçon. He was essentially alone now, on the Pont des Coeurs, the Bridge of Hearts. He stopped to peer over the edge, to cool and calm his thoughts. Reaching out, he felt the old stone, the cold stone wall, and looked down at the dark water. Claude Dussault had suggested he make a wish
and perhaps he should have also thrown a coin into the Fontaine des Mers. It was ironic, of course, to call a site where the terror had taken so many lives the Place de la Concorde, the place of agreement. How many wishes, how many fervent prayers had gone unanswered? Unless the slide of the guillotine was the answer. He wondered now what Dussault had wished for. Gamache turned toward Place de la Concorde, his mind finally settling, coming to a halt. Why had Dussault asked to meet him there, of all places, in front of that fountain, in front of the famous column that marked the guillotine? Armand went over what Dussault said, what Dussault did. Gamache's eyes opened wide.
"Oh, my God," he whispered.
He hailed a taxi. He had to get back to the Place de la Concorde, but on the way he stopped at the Hotel Lutetia. Alain Pinault was no longer in Bar Josephine, nor was he in any of the other bars or restaurants of the Grand Hotel. The front desk called Pinault's room, but there was no answer. Gamache approached the concierge.
"Has Monsieur Pinault asked for a restaurant reservation for tonight?"
"Non, monsieur."
Armand knew that might not be true. Discretion was a vital part of a concierge's job.
"I'd very much appreciate your help in finding a restaurant for this evening," he said, sliding a 100-euro note across the marble top.
"Most of our guests belong to private clubs."
"I've always wanted to join one. Any suggestions?"
He walked out of there with a short list, and the concierge's fingerprint smudging one name. Cercle de l'Union Interalliée. What General de Gaulle had called the French Embassy in Paris.
"May I help you, monsieur?"
the well-dressed woman asked in a hushed voice as he entered the private members' club. Gamache had heard about this place, but had never been in it. The Cercle, in the 8th arrondissement, was a hub for diplomats, political leaders, industrialists, the elite of Paris. In other words, the boards of directors of most of the major corporations in Europe. Armand quickly, instinctively took in his surroundings. The high ceilings, the opulent decor, unchanged from a century earlier. And yet there was nothing faded about its grandeur. It whispered power and glory. Decisions that changed the world, for better or worse, had been made within these walls for 100 years. The woman at the door expertly sized up the man in front of her. Well-groomed, good coat, classic cut, no tie, but crisp white shirt and well-tailored jacket beneath the overcoat. An elegant man, clearly used to a certain authority. But then everyone who came through that door had authority, or they wouldn't get past her.
"Oui, merci. I'm looking for one of your guests, Monsieur Pinault. Alain Pinault."
"Are you a member of a reciprocal club? Perhaps the Mount Royal in Montreal?" How subtly she's made it clear that she'd placed him as a Québécois.
"No, I'm just a visitor. Is Monsieur Pinault here?"
"I really cannot say."
"I understand. If he were here, could you please give him this?"
Gamache handed her the card and saw her face open in a smile.
"Bienvenue. This," she held up the JSPS card, "is your membership. Do you mind?"
Selecting a burgundy and dark blue Pierre Cardin tie, she waited while he did it up, then indicated he should follow her up the wide stairway. At the top, in a hushed voice, she said,
"Wait here, please."
They were at the entrance to a massive room, with groupings of sofas and armchairs. Gamache watched as she walked over to a gathering of men and women, all of whom he recognized from the GHS board. The man looked up as the concierge bent over and handed him the card. Then he looked over. At Gamache. Alain Pinault rose, saying a few words to his companions, and followed the woman to where Gamache was waiting. Corpulent and red-faced from too much wine and too much rich food over too many years. And yet, Gamache thought, there was about him a force. Here was an undeniable personality. Pinault looked at Gamache, then said to the concierge,
"Is there a private salon available?"
Absolutely. Follow me, please, gentlemen.